Well, what a great talk. I think we'll cancel the rest of the program. We'll just discuss the first two. We won't pause for discussion now, but please bring these back into play when we come to our discussion later on. Sally's now going to give us the second case study on smoke-free legislation.
Yes, I'm going to talk about the smoke-free legislation. This is actually a very long story, which probably began around about the 1970s, but you're lucky, I'm actually going to keep it as short as I can and focus on more recent developments. It involved many people, and some of the key players are in the room today, Mary Cuthbert, Lawrence Greer, Anne Ludbrook, and they all contributed very much to the whole process. What I will do first is really look at the use of evidence within the context of the policy cycle. This is a very crude or rough policy cycle, but we'll see how the evidence has been used through from policy review, through to priority setting and policy formulation, then look at how it's been used in terms of policy implementation, and then finally look at how it's been used in terms of policy evaluation. But first of all, I think this a cartoon from Calvin Hobbes really classically explains the policymaker's dilemma. And I'll just leave you just a couple of moments just to read through it. But the punchline is really funny. And I think it's very apt. And I think the challenge for the seminar today is actually how do we develop a system where we allow the knowledge to inform the development of action. It's actually action through knowledge. Last night, Alan and I were having a conversation about terminology. And I think action through knowledge is actually a very interesting term. And what's interesting is you can flip it, because you can say knowledge through action. So you actually get this feedback loop. The case is even made even more difficult. And this is a very nice quote from Rudolf Klein. And it says, most research is ambiguous when it comes to policy. Because the notion you can just read off from a single research project what should be done is complete nonsense. It's made even more problematic because actually research is only one component of a policy decision. As well as the research evidence, we've got evidence about feasibility, we've got evidence about the costs and how they're distributed, and we've got evidence about the political acceptability, either in terms of the general public, the media, or the politicians themselves. And I think it's something that John will pick up in a little bit more detail further on, and actually how we bring these two together. Just to add a little bit more complexity to the picture, policymakers and researchers have quite different accountabilities. Researchers are accountable for the quality of the evidence, and they're accountable to their research funders and their research colleagues, and sometimes to policymakers. But actually, policymakers are accountable for the quality of their decision-making process, and they're accountable to ministers, to senior civil servants, to the general public, and maybe also to the media too. And I think the implication of this, and it's interesting, it's a term that Alan used, I think this process requires a collaborative leadership, which is quite different than some of the models we have already. We have to take into account the difficult issues of the different kinds of evidence. We have to take into account power issues and work together. And I think the discussion about, or the debacle, in fact, about the issue around the Advisory Council on the Misuse of Drugs recently, where we saw David Nutt being sacked, followed by resignations. Actually, there was no evidence there of any collaborative leadership, and I think that is actually an interesting reflection. Okay, so we go on to the focus of the presentation. As you know, the smoke-free legislation came into effect in March 2006, and the most proximal drivers for this were it was a review of tobacco policy. And the review was led by Lawrence Greer with a team of people from the then Public Health Institute for Scotland and Health Education Board for Scotland. They've now merged, they've married, and they've become NHS Health Scotland. And also the NGO, the lead NGO for tobacco, ASH Scotland. And there was a review was conducted that looked at an analysis of current patterns and trends, a rapid review of effective interventions, but importantly, an analysis of current policy and practice. What was very important about this whole review, Mary Cuthbert, who's the policy lead for tobacco, she was there right from the start. She knew exactly what we were doing, attended some of the meetings, and the review and the policy recommendations were developed on a no surprises basis. And this, I think, is a very important aspect of that process. The review was presented in the form of a synthesis of evidence, and it answered four key questions. What's the size of the problem? What interventions work? What are we currently doing, and where are the gaps in what we're doing? And it generated a set of 18 recommendations. Now, it's interesting, a lot of recent reviews have actually generated recommendation lists of about 78, maybe 80 recommendations. What I think is really important here is we focused down very clearly on what the key areas, the key recommendations were. And they focused on prevention, smoking cessation, and regulation and control. And specifically in relation to smoke-free, well, what was recommended was an extension of smoking bans into different arenas, into the workplace, into schools, and also into other public places. But very importantly, it raised the question whether legislation needed to be considered to actually achieve a reduction in the harm. That report then was published, and it went off to the Scottish Government. And then the Tobacco Control Action Plan was published in 2004. And I think, actually, very much to our surprise, I don't know, Lawrence, whether you agree, all the recommendations, practically all the recommendations, were translated into that action plan. And specifically, it called for action or a public debate on secondhand smoke in order to minimise the damage, and set out a number of actions that could be taken. But very importantly, I don't know how usual or unusual this is, it called for independent research to support policy formulation. Just a quick summary here. The factors which I think promoted the uptake of the recommendations, I think there are a number of important things here. First, the team already had an established reputation for evidence synthesis and review, and had close working relationship with the government. Robust evidence was available. For tobacco, it is a bit black and white. The report was very accessible. The evidence was pre-digested, and it was presented in a succinct way, and it answered the right questions, but very importantly, it was very timely. The Scottish government, or the Scottish Executive as they were then known, were looking for answers. Two other points. It built on earlier policy, and it pointed to actions where support and resources were available. But critically, there was also an infrastructure there which could be built upon. So Health Scotland, which I think it had transformed by that point, were actually tasked with the idea of commissioning some of the research. And the three areas that were chosen to focus on were, firstly, what is the extent of morbidity and mortality associated with secondhand smoke? What is the nature of the problem? And then looking at, will a comprehensive ban work? And the international review that I've mentioned here was conducted by Anne Ludbrook and was really very, very important. And it was very important for two reasons. Firstly, it demonstrated that comprehensive bans could reduce mortality and morbidity. But a second part of the work was to actually model the impact for Scotland. So the evidence from other jurisdictions was directly translated into a model for Scotland. And she was able to demonstrate, actually, as well as the mortality and morbidity, there wasn't actually a net negative effect on the hospitality industry. And this was a very important point in the decision in moving towards a comprehensive ban. The third piece of research was about what is the extent of restrictions already in the workplace. And the work from Sally Malam and colleagues was able to demonstrate that, actually, of all the small and medium-sized businesses where smoking restrictions probably weren't in place, only 20% of owners and managers both opposed a smoking ban and didn't currently have anything in place. So it identified the resistance to the ban at a worker level was probably quite low. I think it's quite interesting to reflect now, some years on, what actually happened during the course of 2004. I think at the beginning of the year when the action plan was first published, the idea of legislation was actually dead in the water. It was a non-starter. But gradually, as the Irish legislation, the impact there came through, there was a very high-profile mass media campaign. The massive response to a general consultation, opinion both politically and publicly began to move. And it was a really quite a slow building process. And then between July and September, there was a real discussion about what was happening in other jurisdictions. One, I think it's actually gone down into the mythology of the smoke-free legislation, but it is reputed or reported that the First Minister, when he visited Ireland, he had a long conversation with Michael Martin, who he was a champion of the Irish legislation. When he asked him, when Jack McConnell asked him, would you have done anything differently, the response was more and more quickly. And apparently that was his epiphany on the road to Damascus, and he was converted. So it is said. So we're really, smoke-free legislation is a real possibility. And then between October and November, and Anne Ludbrook will remember this very well, she was suddenly asked to speed through the research to actually speed it up for completion, because they were about to make an announcement. And at this stage, we didn't know for sure, but I think we began to realise the decision was going down the comprehensive route. I think it's important to note at this time, England wasn't. It was a partial ban. Okay. So what were the critical factors in opting for a comprehensive legislation? Firstly, political champions. We had Tom McCabe, who was the Deputy Health Minister, who kicked off and took the lead. And then Jack McConnell came in. Importantly, recently devolved powers to legislate under public health meant that we could actually use the Scottish legislation as a route. We had the implementation evidence from Ireland, and the mass media campaign, which preceded the consultation, precipitated an absolutely massive response. I understand that the normal response is about 5,000. There were 53,000, of which around 80% were positive. And finally, to round things off, we had the independent research. It showed robust evidence was likely to, the health impacts were likely, and the model data indicated there was unlikely to be a negative effect on the hospitality sector and limited opposition in the small and medium-sized enterprises. And the effect of this, I think, was to reduce the political uncertainty about the action. This all supported that move. And so the bill was presented to Parliament in 2004, went through the committee stages, and was eventually passed in June and received royal assent in August 2005. And contributing to that process was a whole series of reviews, briefings, which were presented by public health bodies, scientists, and the NGOs, and these contributed to a successful outcome in the bill actually turning into an act. But I think what was very important about this phase, and also the phase leading up to policy implementation, was there was a comprehensive and integrated communications strategy. And this again built on the experience of the Irish people in particular. As well as leaflets and a website, a government website, there were two very high profile mass media campaigns. But there was another level of activity, which was working with journalists. And it was working with radio, working with newspaper, working with television. And we regularly inputted into that. There was a strategy that included the Scottish Government, Health Scotland, and also the leading NGO. But what became increasingly important was actually that we harmonised the messages, that we were saying the same thing, reporting similar evidence. And also that we countered negative stories coming from the tobacco industry, from the pro-tobacco lobby, and also from the hospitality sector. And these were, I think, very important. But it raises for me some really quite interesting questions about when do you as a scientist move from presenting objective research evidence to becoming a public health advocate, and then finally, are you really a lobbyist? And I don't know where those boundaries are. And I think different people have different views. But I think it's a question we actually have to ask ourselves. When the legislation came through as a comprehensive ban, I think the view was that it was actually going to have, or would likely to have, one of the greatest impacts on public health in Scotland, probably for a generation. And as a result of that, a decision was taken to develop a comprehensive strategy for evaluation. and a group put together a portfolio of studies, of individual studies, combined with routine data that was available over a period of years, and looked at the impact of the legislation on 8 sets of primary outcomes. And this is a summary of the evaluation findings. And really, they exceeded our greatest expectation. We see a massive improvement in air quality, a reduction in exposure, both in bar workers, but also in the general population. We actually weren't expecting this. It was a really quite a big effect. But even more important were the health effects. And we saw this remarkable 17% reduction in admissions for heart attack. Also improvements in respiratory health in bar workers. And we've just done a time series analysis that shows a reduction in tobacco consumption, but importantly, a reduction in smoking prevalence associated with the legislation. We found no evidence of displacement into the home, which was one of the potential adverse consequences, actually, of the legislation. But instead, there were changing social norms about the acceptability of exposing others to secondhand smoke. And I think quite interesting, there was certainly reported increases in smoking restrictions in the home, not only from adults, but also from our children's sample, which suggests it's not simply a social desirability effect. However, and I think this is a very important however, children from households where both parents smoke actually were being still exposed post-legislation to similar occupational levels pre-legislation. And this, so the commissioner's role became different. It switched from a commissioner into a collaborator, and this was an important switch. And in policy terms, I wonder if there's an issue here about the idea of an expert commissioner who might be embedded within government, because I think it is a different role, it's a different kind of role from simple project management. Moving swiftly on, this was a very nice situation, but there are major pitfalls. There are narrow windows of opportunity when you can actually influence priority setting and policy formulation. There are often conflicting policy objectives and stakeholder interests, and I think we see this in sharp relief in relation to alcohol. There's often planned and rapid and unplanned rollout, which really does limit your ability to test whether you can actually see if something works. And there's often lack of investment in time and money. I've said here policies are rarely reviewed. I think that there are actually some very good examples. There was a review of the Diet Action Plan, which Eric Wimbush led, and I think that was an excellent process. But actually, I'm not convinced of what actually happened after that, that feedback loop of the review back into actual action. The net result of this is I think we can't always predict the outcome of the use of evidence. And my gut feeling would be is if we hadn't introduced the smoking ban but delayed until now, I'm not actually convinced it would actually work at this particular time and context. But what does this mean then? If we can't guarantee how evidence is going to be used, I think we perhaps have to look more about the process. And there was a very nice report from the Canadian Health Services Research Foundation that identified 4 key principles about that process. One of transparency, acknowledging that evidence doesn't necessarily force the policy decision, but is part of it. And decisions are often based on value judgments, because I think values come into play a lot here. In terms of reliability, we have to develop a process that is sustainable and results in improvement of the quality of the process and also satisfaction with it. And in terms of inclusiveness, includes a very wide range of stakeholders. And explicitness, and I think this is the bottom line for me. You need to be very clear about who's making the decisions, what evidence is being used, but crucially, what weight is being placed on that evidence. I just want to leave you with a very nice poster. This was in a Derby hospital in 2005. My colleague John Ayres took that photo. Their comms team need a gold star for that. It's a cracker. Okay, thank you very much.
It's a great slide. I didn't mind something going on with it.
Sorry, I have really overrun.
No,
that's disgraceful.
No. It's so nice to hear a Scottish statistical. It might have given you the whole morning to talk about the effects of it. But we're going on now to John's.